and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest someone who has probably one of the most requested guests we've had in the program's history, has been our guest a couple times in the past, but not for a while. Our guest today, Lawrence Lessig, here to talk about the internet, to talk about corruption, to talk about politics. It should be a terrific hour, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But before we go to Larry Lessig, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Consumer and public interest groups sent a letter to FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski asking the commission to take immediate action on several issues surrounding the collection of broadband data. Citing the chairman's many statements about running a fact-based, data-driven agency, the letter asked him to prioritize several pending issues at the agency. S. Derek Turner, research director of Free Press, explains that data collection is an essential component to ensuring universal access to broadband.
This is a fight we've been fighting for years. The FCC has continually put out reports that says all is good in the broadband market in America, and that everything is progressing nicely and that there's no need for a national plan, there's no need for the government to get involved and try to help bring broadband to those of us who don't have it or can't afford it.
In 2007, the Bush administration actually declared that America had achieved universal high-speed internet access, even though 2 years later, 40% of Americans are still not connected. Multiple federal agencies are working on the issue today, including the FCC, which is currently developing a national broadband plan. Meanwhile, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration is rolling out $7.2 billion in stimulus funding to connect unserved and underserved areas. But, as Turner explains, there is still one major problem with these efforts.
Simply put, we don't know where broadband is and isn't in this country, and it's because the carriers, the companies that provide broadband are completely unwilling to hand over that information.
Turner reports that some progress has been made in recent months, but detailed data and coordination between federal agencies is essential to ensuring an effective plan.
We think the FCC's national broadband plan and any broadband policy has to be informed by where service is, who is taking it, why they're taking it, and how much they're paying for it, and what they're getting. So availability, subscription, speed, and price are all very important factors.
Turner says the carriers have fought against providing any of this information to the FCC, but especially on the issue of price.
And we think it's for an obvious reason, because if you start to investigate the relationship between competition and price, I think you're going to see in a lot of areas there's a lack of effective competition, and these companies have kept prices well above what they should be to make a normal profit, and they're essentially gouging consumers, and they're delaying innovation by doing that.
Welcome to One Web Day! Yeah!
For the past 3 years, One Web Day has attracted a global network of organizations and individual activists committed to celebrating the World Wide Web and highlight its potential to improve lives around the world. Cyber law scholar Susan Crawford started One Web Day in 2006, modeling it after Earth Day. The event has grown each year. Crawford has now moved on to become a technology policy advisor to President Barack Obama. Nathan James is One Web Day's new executive director.
It's an opportunity for people to celebrate, to educate their communities, and to encourage activism for the future of the web. We want to see a web that works for everyone. This year in particular, our theme is One Web for All. So it's all about digital inclusion, digital literacy, and working to close digital divides that people face all over the world.
One Web Day is held every year on September 22nd. This year, at least 40 cities have already started planning their One Web Day activities, and there's plenty of time for others to join in. James predicts that more than 50 cities around the world will be celebrating the web this year. The idea is to build an organization that looks, feels, and works like the web, a diverse, decentralized engine of human creativity.
There is a lot of autonomy to One Web Day, and that's one of the things that we like. We really like to walk the talk on the ability of people to self-organize using the internet technologies themselves. But on the other hand, it's traditional organizing. So we hold regular conference calls with some of the lead organizers in cities to make sure that they're still feeling well supported and to find out what they need. We're providing how-to guidelines, how to organize a meeting, how to make your press plan, all of those things that go into traditional organizing, but combining that with the distributed power of the internet and social networks.
There are many ways to get involved in this year's celebration. Projects can be as simple as helping some of your friends update their outdated web browsers.
We'll have lots of projects coming online that you can pretty much just pick up at your desktop and work with us towards a better web. There'll be some things that you can do offline in the communities that you'd like to reach out to, whether they be low-income, youth communities, elder care facilities, libraries, or what have you.
To learn more about One Web Day and the celebrations and activities being held around the world and in your local area, go to onewebday.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today live on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as a guest someone who's been on the program before and been very popular with listeners and had many requests to bring him back. So it's my pleasure to welcome back Larry Lessig, Lawrence Lessig, author of numerous books, most recently Remix, but many others along the way, including Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, The Future of Ideas, and Free Culture. Larry Lessig is a professor formerly at Stanford and going to Harvard. Is that correct, Larry?
That's right. I'm here now.
You're at Harvard now. Okay, terrific. You were there before, then you went out to Stanford, now you're back at Harvard. And you've been involved in a whole range of issues with regard to the internet, with regard to copyright and intellectual property law, and now you're very active in efforts to reduce corruption in Congress. And let's start there, if we can. Larry, tell us about Change Congress, the group you formed, and what you guys are up to.
Sure. So great to be back. Change Congress's aim is to deal with a certain kind of corruption, not really the bribery or Rob Blagojevich kind of corruption, but the kind of corruption that's endemic in our political system when public elections are privately financed, so that members of Congress spend an enormous amount of their time, estimates are between 30 and 70% of their time, actively raising money to get back to Congress as opposed to spending their time addressing the issues that they're supposed to address as leaders of our nation. And so what that does is both lead to distorted policies that don't reflect what the people want, but instead what funders want, and lead most Americans, in my district in California, 88%, to believe that money buys results in Congress, both of which are corrupting of that institution. And so what Change Congress is trying to do is to build, in coalition with a bunch of other fantastic groups like Common Cause and Public Campaign, Public Citizen, trying to build a political movement to support pretty fundamental change in the way Congress gets elected. And what that means right now is basically citizen funding of the nation's elections. There's a bill that's been introduced to support that, and we're trying to leverage to figure out exactly the best way to get that passed.
It seems, Larry Lessig, that we've been getting sort of a case study in corruption of in the health care debate over the past month. It's gotten a lot of publicity. Is that an accurate perception?
That's right. And what we want people to do is to recognize the pattern here. You know, it's not just going to be health care that gets bogged down, maybe stopped by these interests. We also saw the same thing with cap and trade, which was a fantastic bill when originally introduced by Congressman Markey and now has been gutted in the House by special interests that basically bought exemptions and modifications that radically weaken the effectiveness of that bill. Same thing will happen when we get to financial industry regulation. Same thing happened with the bailout, the TARP spending. In each of these areas, fundamental issues of national policy are being distorted by this influence of money because members of Congress can't do anything except try to figure out how to keep their funders happy. Otherwise, they won't get reelected because they won't be able to have the money to get back into Congress. So we want people to begin to connect the dots, to recognize, you know, you might be out there working hard for health care, or out there working hard for the environment, or out there working hard to deal with global warming. But if you don't start spending at least 20% of your time dealing with this more fundamental issue, none of us are going to get what we think we need to get to make this country work the way it needs to.
Larry Lessig, a significant percentage, perhaps even a distinct majority, of members of the House of Representatives come from gerrymandered districts in which they face not a great deal of opposition from the opposing party in the November elections. Why are these guys in the pay so easily if they're pretty much in sort of, you know, Bulgarian elections most Novembers?
Yeah. Well, because the system has evolved so that every member, whether in a safe district or not, has an obligation to raise money for the party. So you are actually taxed as a member of the Democratic caucus to raise a certain amount of money depending upon how long you've been in Congress, what your district looks like. And you're punished if you don't raise that money for the party. You know, there are these leadership PACs that members have, which are basically organizations that allow them to raise money so they can give it to other members of Congress. And there's this extraordinary phenomenon on the floor of the House of Representatives where members walk around the floor handing each other $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 checks. Now, you know, 30 years ago, the idea that you would ever do something this grotesque on the floor of the United States House would have been outrageous to most people. But now it's the normal course of business. This is how the system works.
Larry Lessig, is this a phenomenon that, I mean, I think in the case of healthcare, for example, the ties are clearly to the most strongly to the Republican Party and the Blue Dogs, the Democrats, where we see these cash relationship. Is the Democratic Party, to be blunt, less corrupt on most issues than the Republican Party?
I think it's a problem that hits both of them. You know, I don't know how to measure to say whether it's equally or not, but it hits both of them very strongly. I mean, you know, the issue that you and I got to be friends about originally around media reform and copyright regulation is an issue where the Democrats are just as implicated as the Republicans on any issue. So, you know, we can't get any sensible intellectual property regulation out there because every time any sensible question is raised, extremists turn to their Democratic Party friends to get the Democratic Party to basically put the kibosh on any sensible form of reform. So it's not I think this is a critical insight that actually makes this a very important, potentially progressive in the original sense of the word, meaning not left or right, but just changing the system type of issue, because I think that both parties suffer the exact same problem. They can't focus on what their values or their constituents want because they're spending so much time figuring out what their contributors need. And that economy of influence has become much more significant in just the last 8 years and is going to undermine, I fear, most of what Barack Obama intends to achieve in his presidency.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Larry Lessig, professor at Harvard Law School, noted author of numerous books on intellectual property, the Internet, and now active in Change Congress, which can be found on the web at change-congress.org. Is that right, Larry?
That's right, yeah.
Change-congress.org, which has started in 2008 to battle corruption, institutionalized corruption in the U.S. Congress. That's what we're talking about now. But the phone lines are open to take up any of the issues that Larry Lessig has written and worked on over the past 20 years. 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. You know, Larry, this strikes me as an issue sort of like electoral reform. To use that close relationship to corruption, where our electoral laws are written basically that we pretty much have a guaranteed duopoly because the cost of starting a third party is you help the one of the two parties you'd like the least, the most. So it makes it very difficult to launch a third party, at least at the national level or for national elections or congressional elections. And it seems there's no incentive in either of the two parties to sacrifice their duopoly because that would open them up to competition. Doesn't help them to have that competition. And, you know, as I look at this issue you're working on with corruption of Congress and taking the money out of elections, where are the forces in Congress going to come from who are going to seize this issue and really work hard to advance it, since they're people who are in Congress now are the ones who successfully gained the system and benefit by it.
Well, we are at this extraordinary moment where there's really an opportunity to get this law through Congress because of a couple things that have come together at the same time. Number one, Obama is going to have to address the presidential election public funding system. He's a supporter of public funding but didn't take public funding in the last election because he said the system was broken. He's going to have to fix it. When he proposes that change, there's going to be an opportunity to attach to that the congressional funding election system, which has now been introduced by the number four Democrat in the House, Larson from California. His Republican co-sponsor is Jones, Walter Jones from North Carolina. And in the Senate, the number two Democrat, Dick Durbin, had co-sponsored originally with Ireland Spector, but now they're trying to locate another Republican to be the co-sponsor. And this bill is actually very different from the public funding bills that have been considered before, because this is kind of public funding plus Barack Obama, in the sense that the system works by you've got to clear some hurdles to get an initial chunk of money, kind of grub stake from the state to run your campaign. But then you can raise as much money as you want in $100 contributions or less. So what that does is it means you can spend less of your time on the telephone talking to people who are going to secure $10,000 or $15,000 contributions or collections of contributions to your campaign, and more of your time meeting constituents. And also, if you do need to raise money, raising money from the vast majority of Americans as opposed to raising money from the top 0.5%. This bill has a substantial amount of support now in the House. And what we're leveraging with Change Congress and with Common Cause and with Public Campaign is a way to build the co-sponsorship and to push it over. Now, Change Congress has taken on a kind of bad cop role in this game. You know, the Common Causes of the world, they're well-respected nonprofits that have been good guys for a long time. They're going to be telling the positive side of the story. We are in the business of embarrassing members of Congress because of their, you know, what I think is corrupt behavior by accepting money from the interests that they regulate, right? So we attacked John Conyers in one bill related to open access in science. We did a very substantial attack against Ben Nelson, sent him, I think, over the edge because he took $2 million from insurance companies and then said that he was going to block the public option in healthcare, said it would be a deal breaker. And basically what we have started to do is to identify these members who have voted inconsistently with their constituents or their principals, but consistently with their money. And what we say to them is not, you know, we think you've been bought, but we say you're behaving in exactly the way that leads 88% of Americans to believe money buys results in Congress. And that is corrupting the institution, and you either can stop accepting money from people you're trying to regulate, or you can vote to change the system so that nobody could ever say again that money is corrupting the system.
Larry Lessig, this problem extends, of course, to regulatory agencies like the Federal Communications Commission, where the five commissioners don't have to run for office. So once they're in, it's an appointed office. They have to be approved by the U.S. Senate. And one of the measures that, even though there are no campaign contributions, that tend to work very much in industry's benefit there, among many, but the one primary one is that members of the FCC, with very few exceptions when they leave the FCC, go to industry and receive extremely lucrative jobs. In the case of the last two chairs of the FCC, jobs that go to seven figures a year in terms of annual income. And, you know, it seems like that's an issue, too, that if members of Congress know they or their relatives are going to leave public life and then go to work for the lobby for an enormous industry, that's terrific incentive to serve them while in public life, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I think that we have to recognize the systemic problem here. It reaches through every bit of Washington, D.C. right now. So one of my favorite members of Congress recently told me that he now views Congress as kind of, or Capitol Hill as a kind of farm league for K Street. So members of Congress expect not to spend their whole life in Congress. They expect to serve three or four terms, earning a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. then they'll cash in and become a lobbyist earning $500,000 or $1 million a year. It's a business model very much like my law students who expect to be associates at big firms and then after 7 or 8 years become partners making a substantial amount of money. It's the same thing with staffers on Capitol Hill. They think, you know, if I'm on the committee of the agriculture for 4 or 5 years, then I can go off and become an agricultural lobbyist and make, you know, a substantial amount of money. And it's also a problem that is endemic inside of the agencies. But interestingly, agencies have had the longest history of worrying about this. And in some sense, you know, it's a very hard problem in the context of the agencies because, you know, if you look at the people who we need to, for example, run the Treasury or run the SEC or run any of these regulatory agencies, there's a lot of overlap in personnel unless you imagine people spending their whole career inside of government. And at an earlier stage of the New Deal legislation, that's what people thought. You would go to the SEC, you'd be a regulator in the SEC for your whole life. But, of course, today, the amount of money that people get paid inside the government versus outside, the amount of money they get paid outside of the government makes it impossible for anybody to think about spending their whole life in that type of position, so that you have very few who are career regulators like this and many more who are opportunistic regulators presenting exactly the kind of problem you've created. Now, I'm not sure how you get around that problem except by dealing with some fundamental issues around the agencies. So I wrote a piece in Newsweek about 6 months ago calling for that we said we should blow up the FCC, that, you know, its DNA was essentially the DNA of protecting dominant interest in media and communications. That's what it's done since its very beginning. You don't change DNA, you just kill it. And the only way to create an agency that would be achieving what I think should be achieved in the context of media would be just get rid of that one and start again with some fundamental principles guiding that new agency. And one of them, I think, has got to be thinking about how we get the right kind of people inside the government who don't see this as just a way to leverage more money once they get out of government.
Our guest, Larry Lessig, we're talking to you live on the phone. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Dr. Lessig, the telephone number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've been talking about Change Congress, the organization that Larry Lessig founded with Joe Trippi in 2008 that's working to take the corruption, the institutionalized corruption, out of Capitol Hill. But we'll also be talking during the course of the program, and you can certainly call and ask questions about the state of the Internet and intellectual property, Supreme Court, any of the other issues that Dr. Lessig has written about so thoroughly and so well over the past decade. Larry, one question I want to get to is that in doing some research not too long ago for another project, I came across a University of Chicago economist, and if I'm not mistaken, I've read several of these guys. One of them had my surname, though we're no relation to my knowledge. And he made the argument, or this economist made the argument, that in fact campaign donations by private industry are not just something that are corrupting the process, but they're actually the oxygen for a healthy democracy. And that when you look at what private interests get for their money, they actually get an extraordinarily high return for their contributions in terms of the policies and subsidies they get as a result. And that, in fact, we should probably have a great deal more spending by business to paying politicians, but that the money will produce the best outcome because if it's really important and it's rational for a market economy, those private interests will spend more to get it implemented. I suspect you've seen that argument. I wonder what your take is on it.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of crazy. I think that, you know, one of the greatest moments in this whole debate that I've been having in the past 6 months was about a week ago when I was having a debate with Richard Epstein, of course, a very famous libertarian from the University of Chicago. And we both agreed that public funding was necessary to deal with what we both saw were problems in the way government functioned. And the reason he agreed with it is that he sees the biggest problem with government is rent-seeking, as an economist would put it, meaning people going to government, getting special deals from government, getting government to cut them special deals so that they're better off relative to their competitors. Now, it's certainly true today that it makes an enormous amount of sense for a business to be investing a huge amount of money in lobbyists in Washington, because the return on that investment is very high for that business. But it's a very different thing to say the return to society is high, right? You know, when the businesses basically lobby to get, in effect, a kind of government-granted monopoly for something, sure, that's good for the monopolist, but the monopoly is not good for society, right? So in one study done by the University of Kansas just about 4 months ago, they concluded that the return on investment from lobbying in this one particular bill was 22,000%. Now, if you're a business person and you're thinking, I could invest my money and invest in inventing the next great mousetrap or buying some good regulation from Washington, obviously, if you're facing returns something like 22,000%, you're going to spend your time not innovating and developing great new products, but finding ways to get the government to cut new regulations that benefit you and hurt your competitors. And that's that, you know, so I think it's perfectly rational for businesses to be doing what they're doing. But I think what we need then is a way to check that, to limit that. And one way to limit it is to give members of Congress at least the freedom to say no. Because right now they don't have that freedom. Right now, you know, they're dependent upon this money. And if they say no, then they're going to turn out not to be able to raise the money they need either for themselves or for their party.
Larry Lessig, are there members of Congress we can point to in the past 5 or 10 years who have, you know, dared to go against the tide, say, I'm not going to play this game, and suffered consequences for it?
Well, you know,
or candidates, maybe, if not elected members.
There have been many campaigns which have run, refusing to take certain kinds of money. And depending on your district, that works. But I actually am not a big I don't really have a lot of great things to say for those particular members, because what that tends to do is to lead people to say, look, if this is an issue, then people, you know, candidates can run on this as an issue and they can choose not to take money and the public will elect them. And that's very misleading, because while it's true in some districts you can get away with that, it's certainly not true that you could run, you could build a Congress that was filled with people who didn't depend upon money to get into Congress. And the problem we've got to resolve is, how do we produce a Congress where members can focus on what's right and good for the country as opposed to what's right and good for them getting elected?
Larry Lessig, I haven't seen the statistics recently, but I know that a few years ago when I looked at the statistics, the closer a candidate's election was to the House or the Senate, the higher the percentage of the money went to television advertising. And in very close races, oftentimes the amount of money that went to television candidate ads would approach 70, 80, 85% of all the funds they raised. And I assume something like that still holds true, but with television declining and the rise of the internet, is there going to be less pressure to raise money on candidates just because there you won't have the same place to spend it to reach people?
Maybe sometime in the far future, but every single election since, you know, basically the time the Republicans took over control of the House, where it became really competitive between the two parties, the cost of elections has gone through the roof. And part of the reason is, you know, a reason that you know very well, as the communications laws put less pressure on the broadcasters to effectively subsidize political speech, the cost of political speech went through the roof. So the cost of campaigns went through the roof, which drove people to this insane behavior, which is, you know, if you want some great sources for it, and if you haven't had them on your show, you certainly should. Robert Kaiser has a fantastic book that's just come out called So Damn Much Money. Mm-hmm. And he maps this growth of control of the lobbyists, you know, in a period of just like the last 15 years, this has had this dramatic change. And a big part of it is just people, you know, both parties can't afford not to be raising these astronomical amounts of money. And how else are they going to do it except by effectively trading legislation for campaign contributions?
You know, Larry, as I hear you say that, I think back upon when I came of age in the late 60s and 1970s, I remember people who started groups like Common Cause then making a similar argument that there was immense corruption in Washington. And I recall how President Eisenhower, although I was very young then, in his farewell address in 1961, talked about the military-industrial complex. And as I know you know, he initially called it the military-industrial congressional complex and took that out as a favor to friends of his in the Congress. But even then, so I was predating the 1994 Republican election, there was sort of a sense that corruption ruled the day in Washington. So help me out, figure this out. I mean, was it the corruption just worse now, or is it qualitatively different? But it sure seemed, to people back in the 60s and 70s, it was awfully corrupt then.
Yeah, corruption of some form has been with us from the very beginning. And if you think of the kind of corruption that we think of as the worst, like kind of Rob Blagojevich corruption or bribery, that kind of corruption, from the very beginning of the Republic, we've had that kind of corruption. And, the 19th century was a cesspool, and Congress was a cesspool of corruption. I mean, even at the very beginning, there's a very famous story of Hamilton, when Hamilton negotiated the renegotiation of the debts of the Revolutionary War. So all these Revolutionary War paper was trading at about 25 cents on the dollar. And he got Congress to agree to back that debt so that it would be fully paid off. But just before Congress voted on this issue, after the deal had been set, members of Congress went out into the countryside and started buying up this debt at 22 cents on the dollar. And then they came back to Washington and they voted. And they put the government's stamp of backing on this debt, and it was worth 97 to 100 cents on the dollar, right? So this set Jefferson over the edge, and he went to Washington and he said there at least ought to be a rule that says you can't vote on something that you've got a direct financial interest in. And Washington, with Madison, kind of laughed at Jefferson's naivete about how politics could work, right? So this is I'm not saying that we've ever had a golden era of non-corruption. In fact, if we've had a period where Congress has not been driven by that kind of grotesque kind of personal gain corruption, that's this period. I think this period, as my colleague Dennis Thompson has described, this period is the least corrupt in that venal sense of corruption. Instead, what we've got now is a much more open, much more honest, up on the surface system of influence, which doesn't personally benefit members in the sense of, getting them a car or getting them a fancy house, but does benefit members in the sense of getting them tenure, right? This is the way they get tenure in their job. You and I had to write papers or books. They have to raise money. So I think that what we're seeing is that the character of the corruption is different. And interestingly, counterintuitively, I think the harm of this corruption is much greater than the harm of the other kind of corruption, at least at certain periods in the history of the country. So, think of the extraordinary amount of influence that was brought to bear to make sure that the federal government had no effective regulatory authority over this explosion of new financial instruments that finally blew up our financial system last year, right? Exemption from regulation that was purchased by Wall Street interests who went to people like Chuck Schumer and got Chuck Schumer and Bob Rubin to fight as hard as they could to make sure there wouldn't be regulation here, had a dramatically catastrophic effect on the United States, much worse than anything, Randy Duke Cunningham ever did when he took bribes to get defense contracts. So I think we need to, recognize in some sense, this is a familiar story in the context of Germany during the war. It's the good Germans here that are, the ones that are more responsible for the harm, like the people who are, decent members who are of society and of Congress who are not doing something very small that they would have to do to change the system. They're leading to a much worse outcome than the people who are motivated by how do I get rich in Washington.
Larry Lessig, our guest. We have a caller patiently waiting, but before we get to that caller, I do want to do a follow-up on this, Larry. Yeah, I had Kevin Phillips on a few months ago. He's written a book called Bad Money, and he talked about the transition to finance capital and how it dominates our politics And he argued therein and on the program that finance capital, the really big money guys who've made a killing over the last two decades, has gravitated largely to the Democratic Party. They still own the Republicans, but they put a lot of their effort in the Democratic Party, not just for presidential races, but for congressional as well. And he signaled Obama as a, you know, a recipient of finance capital's largesse in his political career. Do you think that's true? And if that is true, does that undermine your optimism? Because I know you've been optimistic about President Obama as someone who's interested in change.
Well, you're exactly right. I have been optimistic about President Obama. I'm very concerned about whether he is being ambitious enough in his conception of what kind of change is necessary here. You know, you get the feeling that he thought he could walk into Washington and wow the United States Congress into implementing a series of changes in legislation that would have a dramatic effect on very powerful special private interests without those private interests fighting back, not recognizing that the only way he was going to make it possible for him to have the kind of change effect that he wanted was to directly work to change the underlying economy of influence which guides Washington. So I'm worried right now in the context of Obama. And I'm worried for exactly the reason that you're describing about the enormous influence of this kind of capital. If you look at the global warming legislation, you know, the simple economist solution to the problem of greenhouse gases is to figure out what tax you need to impose on carbon to raise the money that you would need to clean up the carbon that's being spewed into the air. Just like, you know, you think about garbage that you throw out your back door, what we've done is in a civilized society, figure out how much we've got to charge people in order to pick up that garbage and do something with it. Now, that simple tax system has been ignored in the context of figuring out a solution. And instead, what we've looked for is these enormously complicated cap-and-trade-like systems, which, you know, have this theoretical advantage, efficiency advantage, only slightly. But one thing it absolutely has an advantage for is putting to work all those Wall Street traders who now don't have any work because they, you know, the mortgage sham that they were running for the last 3 years has collapsed around them. So all of a sudden, Wall Street has a new great little bubble that they can exploit and make enormous amounts of money because of the way that the system works in concentrating the return. Will we be getting a better environmental policy than we would if we just had the old-fashioned, you know, let's figure out what the tax is and let's figure out how much to clean up the carbon system? I don't think so, and I think this is evidence for the thesis that what we've got is a system that's being driven by private interest rather than by sensible public policy.
Our guest today, Larry Lessig, who's joining us on the phone. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, author of many books, including Remix and Free Culture on the Internet and on the changing nature of our society, expert on intellectual property. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Let's get to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Well, thank you for the interesting program this afternoon. It's keeping me from my nap. I am interested in your assessment of the media's complicity in promoting the race for funding. The media constantly promotes the idea that those who have the biggest war chests are going to be the winners. And so the news story becomes the war chest rather than anything else. And so a candidate needs to build up a war chest. I think the media has some blame in the whole matter, too. Would you comment on that, please? I'll listen off the air.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Larry Lessig?
Well, it's an interesting thesis, you know, what's cause and what's effect. And I guess I'd be skeptical that the mere fact that they're reporting on the need for a large war chest is producing the need for the large war chest. I think the large war chest is being, the need for the large war chest is being produced by the dramatic rise in costs of running these types of campaigns, rise both in television costs and in the cost of professional consulting. I mean, that's become a huge new cost inside of campaigns that, you know, when you think of the polling costs, the cost of these sophisticated ways of tracking trends and attitudes, that is, you know, a real factor that makes one campaign more effective than another campaign. So if candidates were ending their campaigns with, you know, in competitive districts at least, with lots of money that they didn't think they needed to spend, then I guess that might be support for the caller's thesis. But I think there are other, you know, things that are driving the results that isn't so much just the media hyping something that's not true.
Let me add to a twist to that, Larry Lessig, then. You know, there was an interview a year and a half ago on Keith Olbermann's program, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, and he had John Cleese, the great English comedian, on with him. And Cleese, I guess, is an admirer of Olbermann. And Cleese is praising the show, and he said, well, the one thing I don't like about American television is all these TV ads for candidates. And Olbermann half kiddingly said, no, we can't talk about that. That's where we get all our money. And, you know, our commercial broadcast news, this doesn't apply to print media as much, but our broadcast news certainly, all those stations get a growing and dramatic portion of their revenues now comes from these candidate ads. Is there a tension there that maybe might corrupt some of the coverage?
Well, it might, and I think you're right that the biggest thing driving the change in costs is the television stations feeling that this is an enormous source of income that they can't afford to give up. So, you know, the FCC used to have a pretty strong hand in the mix to make sure that they didn't exploit this opportunity the way they have, and the FCC's backed away from that, and some believe because constitutionally they could only back away from it. But I guess I have not seen enough, and it might, you know, I'm just not something I'm studying right now, but I'd be interested to know whether there's any good evidence to support the idea that they're explicitly or self-consciously changing the character of reporting for the purpose of ginning up more television ads from candidates. Might be, just I haven't seen anything.
Yeah, I doubt it would be explicit. I think this is the sort of thing sort of implicitly sort of internalized. One doesn't have to be told what to do. I mean, the other point along those lines with regard to media coverage is that traditionally political coverage in this country is driven by one candidate's criticism of another candidate, sort of making that a legitimate issue, therefore, for journalists. But if both candidates buy into the system, you don't have anyone in the legitimate official sources raising it as an issue. It's
right.
Much more difficult for journalists to raise it as an issue without being accused of being unprofessional and ideological.
Right. I think that I certainly agree with that. Although this is one area where I think we're seeing a lot of change as alternative sources of, quote, media become more and more significant, more salient. So, you know, because this is a target that's moving so quickly, I'd be interested to see what more we could learn about it before figuring out what the right, you know, intervention would be about it. You know, it's hard to compare media even 15 years ago to media today with the range of perspectives that are included if you include something beyond, you know, the boring broadcast media, which, of course, has been the dominant form for such a long time.
Our guest today in Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Dr. Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Harvard Law School. Are you a doctor, actually? I don't know if that's...
Yeah, you should. I'm always anxious about that word. I'm not really a doctor in the way that you think of it.
You're not a PhD?
I'm not a PhD.
Okay, so
PhD.
Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School, author of many books, including Free Culture and Remix, and now the co-founder with Joe Trippi of the group. We've been talking about their work for the whole program so far, Change Congress. You can find that on the web at change-congress.org. Our phone lines are open. We have time for a couple more calls at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line right now. Portland, thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hi, good afternoon. On the issue of public funding, I'm curious whether there are other countries with particularly effective publicly funded election systems that we could use as models to implement here.
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually have taught this is a issue in a seminar a couple of years, and I had a student last year who did a really comprehensive, fantastic survey of every single public funding system in the world. And one of the problems that makes the comparison hard is that other countries don't have the same kind of constitutional restriction on the ability to regulate the largest cost factor, which is television. So many countries, mandate free television for candidates. Many countries restrict the opportunity for people to spend outside of parties. So those policy levers are just not available to us because our First Amendment has been interpreted in a way that would require that we can't force television stations to subsidize in that direct way, and you can't stop people from speaking inside or outside the party unless they're opting into a funding system like the one that we're promoting with Change Congress. What I think we do see, though, is that the level of interest that are bought on core core issues is different. I wouldn't say any place is beautiful or perfect. Scandinavian countries are getting closest in the sort of low corruption factor, but they're better. So think about countries all across Europe that are basically comparable to us, who have public funding systems, have found it possible to have meaningful health care, have actually on their own taken steps to deal with global warming. Those are exactly the kind of issues that we are consistently stymied in our ability to address, in large part, I think, because of the extraordinary opportunity those interests have to block anything by the way our funding system works. So there's some, I guess I would say the evidence from other countries is enough to be encouraged to continue to push this, but I don't think we have any country that I would say directly maps to our situation.
Larry, I wonder, when this issue comes up and I'm talking to people, oftentimes people will nod in firm agreement, I think, with virtually everything you've said. And then everyone rushes immediately to the judgment. Well, this is an issue that is too abstract. It's too removed from the daily experiences of Americans, from the genuine concerns about health care, about nuts and bread and butter issues that drive people's political convictions, that it's too much for college professors and that crowd. And therefore, you can never organize around it. It's never going to be a front burner issue. It's something you have to sort of sneak through the back door in a huge New Deal type reform program. I suspect you've thought a lot about this issue, and I suspect you've heard this comment before. How do you respond?
I think that comment has been true for most of our past, but it's not true today. And the best evidence of it not being true today is that, in fact, we've produced exactly this kind of reform at the state level, now in three states, Arizona, Maine, and just last time, Connecticut. At the federal level, I think that as I said, the problem is much worse, and the perception after this administration, 2 years into this administration, is going to be much more acute, that the problem we face is not any particular problem, but it's systemic. I think at the birth of this administration, we would go talk to the global warming people and say, we need your help on this. And they're like, no, we got to work on global warming. And we talk to the healthcare people and say, we need your help on this. And they say, no, we care about healthcare. Talk to the environment people, they say, no, we care about the environment. And our constant point to them was, look, you've got to stop caring only about your issue because your issue is never going to pass unless we solve this other issue. That argument is more salient now. And I think more and more ordinary people, not college professor types, but ordinary people are going to see that healthcare has been stopped because the system is corrupt. Global warming reform has been stopped because the system is corrupt. It's the same refrain, and until we can get back to fixing the system that is corrupt, we're not going to see any of the changes that America supports. So we've got, a challenge about how to do this. And at the Netroots Nation conference yesterday, I was able to announce, I was very, very happy about two things we were able to announce. One of them is the fact that Shepard Fairey, who of course is an icon in a certain for a certain cultural important part of our culture, has taken this on as one of his most important issues, and he wants to join our board, and he's going to join our board and help frame this issue in a way that speaks to a new generation. Mark McKinnon, a very important Republican who mm-hmm. was a McCain supporter and had to step away when he realized that McCain was going to be fighting against Obama, but a credible Republican who believes in this issue, has also joined our board to help us figure out how to frame this in a way that doesn't sound like it's just talking to liberals. And so I think that that combination of, you know, diversity and focusing on a message that speaks to a wider range of people is the chance we have. But, you know, my view is, even if you convinced me that it was impossible to win this, I think we've got no choice still to fight. In fact, that's all the reason in the world to fight for it, because if we don't get it, at some stage, our country has got to get it if this democracy is going to survive, right? You know, there's a fantastic book title. I haven't read the book yet, but the book title kind of captures my sense of it. The title is "Are We Rome?" Right? Are we at the edge of the abyss for this democracy? And when you look at the enormous power to dislodge addressing fundamental critical issues, not just the issues like copyright that was my focus for so long, but issues, you know, the most important issues, then unless we find a way to solve that problem soon, I think we're going to wonder whether we've got anything of a democracy left.
That inspires me, Larry, to think of a comment I think Maureen Dowd wrote this past week in the New York Times, and I'm paraphrasing. I don't have the column in front of me, but I circled it and clipped it because it got my attention. And she made a comment about the paradox that we're in a time in which more people have more access to more information than even imaginable 15 years ago, or 10 years ago for that matter. Yet at the same time, we seem to be dominated by more misinformation, propaganda, and ignorance and memory as well. A stunning paradox. And you've written about the internet, I think, as brilliantly, and you've been really in many respects the mentor for many of us in sort of understanding the potential of the internet, but also the policy issues that are crucial to be resolved to make the internet fulfill its potential. We've only got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and this is a big subject, but I would like your sense in 2009 of where the digital revolution is at and why Maureen Dowd is writing things like that.
Well, I think that the big challenge is to figure out how to turn this technology into something sustained and constructive. You know, this is kind of is a trivial way to see this, to think of, you know, the Twitterization of dialogue, which, you know, I'm a big fan of Twitter. I Twitter a lot. I've got a lot of people following what I do when I Twitter. But there's this kind of weird sense that we're, you know, at a place where if you can't say it in 140 characters, you're not going to be heard. And while there's a lot of things that, you know, are appropriately said in 140 characters, a lot of these issues are going to take more than 140 characters to get people to recognize. So, you know, the point that you just pushed to me, like how are we going to get people to see this systemic problem? It's going to take more than 140 characters. And unless the internet can begin to really help that, I think we're going to have a lot of, you know, for Maureen Dowd, like reasons, a lot of concern about what the future of deliberative democracy looks like.
You've been working, of course, on copyright and intellectual property issues and how they should and should not be applied to the digital realm or in general. What do you think the main, for my listeners who are concerned about the internet and want to see it fulfill its democratic potential, can you list and describe maybe one or two of the big policy fights they should be concerned with at present and in the coming years?
Well, you know, I think one big policy fight that's related to copyright is just, you know, how to restore some balance, some reasonableness to the way copyright system functions, right? The insanity of constantly waging war against a generation for the way that they use this technology when there are alternatives that could achieve everything copyright law seeks to achieve without turning a generation into criminals is astonishing. And, you know, somebody, you know, at some point our democracy's got to get around to facing that issue, because the potential, if this system were well regulated, for the kind of speech that we're interested in to grow is huge. But there is a problem. It's not really a copyright problem. It's a journalism problem. The problem of how do we continue to support investigative journalism in the digital age is very significant because, of course, you know, the combination of technologies like Craigslist plus the free availability of the news in all sorts of contexts puts enormous competitive pressure on the institutions that used to fund investigative journalism, which, of course, is a fundamental public good in any democracy. And as they no longer have the opportunity to subsidize this public good, we got to think about how we produce it. And I don't think anybody has a clear sense of what way to do that now. I mean, some people are talking about enabling newspapers or similar journalistic enterprises to be intentional nonprofits so that people could contribute and get tax deductions for their contributions, and also that journalists could be more strongly committed to ideals that wouldn't bend in the face of commercial pressure. That might be one solution. ProPublica is a nonprofit that does investigative journalism that makes its work available after the investigations are done to other news sources. That might be another. But this is a significant issue that, you know, I think we have to get beyond the I'm for the Internet or I'm against the Internet framing and recognize we're going to have an Internet, and given the Internet, how do we continue to get the important things society needs? And investigative journalism is a critical part of the thing we need.
In the last year, as newspapers have been closing down and newsrooms have been boarded up and journalists have been laid off both at newspapers and television stations, there's very little radio journalism left in the commercial media. So that was dead a decade ago. But as this has taken place, commercial media owners, especially the large firm owners like Rupert Murdoch, have been pressing to see that sort of they set up a pay-for system or a paywall system online where people will not be able to access the news produced by commercial news media unless they pay for it in some form. They're still hashing it out, but Rupert Murdoch has announced already that he's planning to set up a paywall system for his army of newspapers and news sites from around the world. Do you think that's going to work from your understanding of the Internet, that we could have a system where there'd be a paywall and all the commercial news media be behind it, and you have to pay to get in, or some sort of system, and that will, Rupert Murdoch's, the way he describes it, this period we've had of the Internet for the last 10 or 15 years will quickly be forgotten. It'll be sort of like the pre-broadcasting days of ham radio in 1919. It'll fade into the history books. Do you think he's onto something?
I don't. I think the mistake he's making is failing to remember exactly why ham radio or, you know, free radio died. And that's because heavy-handed regulation by the government. In this context, I just, you know, for lots of the reasons that, you know, beguile campaign finance reformers, I just don't see how the government can step in and support the kind of restriction on access that would be necessary to support the kind of cartel behavior that he talks about when he says we're going to close down access to free information. The fundamental problem newspapers face is that they're providing effectively a commodity, and they start trying to charge more for it. People are going to go other places to get the same commodity for free. You know, what they're providing is access to news information, and in the world of competition for the supply of that, when one side starts closing down access for free, people go other places. Now, there are exceptions. You know, I think the Wall Street Journal has been able to do it because they're providing a kind of information, financial information, which is not easily accessible through 1,000 other sources. So I'm not saying it's not possible for any of them, but I do think that, you know, if you start thinking about the mainstream range of stuff that you get through Google News or something like that, you're not going to see a revolution the way he's describing.
Larry Lessig, I see that our time is drawing to a close. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good luck with your work. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Please come back and join me in a week with my producer, Melissa Trentz, and Kyle Kroha, my engineer and our guest in 167 hours will be Glenn Greenwald. Have a great week, everyone.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny skies today with a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high reaching 88 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, low around 70. And showers and thunderstorms are likely tomorrow with a high of 85 degrees. And the showers continue tomorrow night with a low of 68. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM.